Good afternoon, listeners. This is the Dogs Program. We're here every week at 12 midday to promote and to defend public education. And it's been a very eventful week with the teachers on strike, and we'll have more on that next week. But Trevor Colbould has also been doing more research. He's produced a very scholarly paper on fully funding private schools being no way to increase equity in education. Well, we could have told him that, of course. We think that there's no way that you should fund private schools because you'll never get equity. They're never going to be about equity, and they've never been about equity. But he's had quite a lot of press coverage with this paper, so let's hear it, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. This is an article by Trevor Colbould on the Save Our Schools website. Fully funding private schools is no way to increase equity in education. This is a summary of a paper showing that full taxpayer funding of private schools, subject to them charging no fees, will not increase equity in education. The full paper can be downloaded at the Save Our Schools website. A critical question in assessing the proposal of Tom Greenwell and Chris Bonner to fully fund private schools, subject to them not charging fees and allowing open enrolments, is whether and to what extent it would increase equity in education. Even in the highly unlikely event that any private school system is prepared to give up its current resource advantage over public schools, it is equally unlikely to increase equity in education. To see this, we must be clear on what is equity in education. Save Our Schools long ago adopted a dual equity objective, which was also adopted by the Gonski Review of School Funding. It comprises an individual and social goal. 1. All students should achieve a Year 12 certificate or its equivalent. And 2, students from different social groups should achieve similar average school outcomes. Despite their significant resource advantage over public schools, Catholic and independent schools perform no better than public schools after adjusting for different social composition. In some cases, they do worse in achieving equity goals. Successive reports on Australia's results in the OECD's Program for International Student Assessment, PISA, show that after adjusting for student and school socioeconomic background, results in Catholic schools are significantly below those of public schools, while those of independent schools are slightly below those of public schools. Catholic schools do no better than public schools, even after only adjusting for student-level socioeconomic background. Also, Catholic and independent schools experienced the biggest declines in outcomes in PISA results since 2009. In addition, several studies over the past 10 years show that NAPLAN results of private schools are no better than those of public schools after adjusting for socioeconomic background. Given this poorer performance, it is very difficult to believe that attracting more disadvantaged students to Catholic and independent schools by making them fee-free will improve equity in school outcomes. First, private schools will have less income per student than now because they would be required to give up the resource advantage provided by their ability to charge fees. Second, on the most optimistic scenario, it will take considerable time to attract sufficient disadvantaged students to the private sector to give them a similar demographic profile to that of public schools. For as long as this takes, probably forever, fee-free private schools will have less income per student than public schools because their lower proportion of disadvantaged students will mean less per student funding from the Gonski disadvantage funding loadings. If private schools cannot match public schools with the resource advantage they enjoy under the current funding system, how can we expect funding them at the same level as public schools will increase equity in education? There can be no confidence this will occur. While sharing the concerns of many about very high social segregation between schools in Australia, the best we can do is to minimise its effect on school outcomes. Some degree of social segregation is inevitable because of geographical differences and a host of government policies, such as housing and urban planning. In its starkest form, there will always be high social segregation between schools in the eastern suburbs of Sydney and Melbourne and those in remote areas. Fully funding private schools could even lead to more religious segregation, encouraging the expansion of schools catering for religious minorities such as Muslims, Hindus, Buddhists, and Sikhs, the large majority of whom currently attend public schools. This does not fit well with the current concerns about social cohesion. A more direct and preferable way to reduce social segregation and its effects on school outcomes is to encourage more advantaged families to remain in public schools by ensuring that public schools are fully funded and better able to deal with the challenges that they face. It is not clear whether Tom and Chris propose full taxpayer funding of private school will include funding for capital infrastructure. If not, private schools will have to continue to charge fees in order to fund capital development. If it does include government funding for capital, taxpayers would incur billions in capital funding of private schools in future. Catholic and independent schools currently spend $6 billion a year on buildings and land. If governments fund private school buildings and land, they should retain ownership of the assets to protect taxpayer interests. Transferring ownership to private schools would allow them to sell off schools to gain more revenue and then apply for more capital funding to establish a new school. They could also transfer ownership to a related organisation to avoid any legal claims on assets, such as compensation for child sexual abuse, as in the case of Christian Brothers transferring schools to Edmund Rice Australia for $1. SOS considers that full funding of public schools and reducing the overfunding of private schools as fundamental to increasing both aspects of equity in education. In the first instance, full funding of public schools means funding them at 100% of their schooling resource standard, the SRS, including ending the accounting tricks of allowing state governments to claim a range of non-SRS expenditures as part of their share of funding public schools. But full funding means more than this. It means increasing the disadvantaged funding loadings. For example, the average low socioeconomic status loading is about 0.2 at present, but numerous research studies suggest it should be at least 1.0 or more, even up to 3.0. Such loadings are estimated as necessary to allow all students to achieve average standards. The loadings would have to be even higher to achieve social equity in education by eliminating the achievement gaps between rich and poor. Similarly, ending the overfunding of private schools means more than reducing their current funding to 100% of their SRS. It means ending their special funding outside the model, such as the $1.2 billion Choice and Affordability Fund, removing their tax-deductible status for building funds and foundations, and removing exemptions to payroll tax and local government rates. In addition, private schools are massively overfunded because of the flaws in their funding model. The current model ignores the substantial income that many parents in private schools receive from grandparents, the bank of mum and dad, when assessing the capacity of parents to contribute financially. It also ignores hundreds of millions in donations, investment income, rental income, and other income of private schools. As a result, the financial need of private schools is overestimated and they are overfunded. Ending the huge underfunding of public schools and the overfunding of private schools would allow much progress in achieving equity in education. SOS has proposed a Gonski Plus model to do this. A four-pronged campaign is the way forward. 1. Advocate full funding of public schools based on a Gonski Plus model. 2. highlight evidence showing that public school outcomes are equal to or surpass those in the private sector after adjustment for the different demographics. 3. Reaffirm the social role of public schools in promoting a common understanding of social responsibility, human rights, and social justice. And 4. Continue to document the huge achievement gaps between rich and poor and make the case for greater equity in student outcomes. And that full article is at the Save Our Schools website. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Dale. And of course, the education gap between rich and poor has been growing for some time, particularly since the 1980s. But here is Andy with a very interesting article that was written a few weeks ago. Over to you, Andy.
Thanks, Jean. The education gap between rich and poor students is growing. These schools may have the answer. Disadvantaged students are worse off today than when NAPLAN was introduced, as the chasm between rich and poor students in Australia grows, new research shows. A new analysis of 17 years of NAPLAN data conducted by Victoria University's Mitchell Institute shows inequality has become a feature of schools across Australia, and that in almost all cases, learning gaps are widening as students progress through school, with enduring and persistent learning gaps becoming more entrenched. The study, which included 2008 to 2022 data and 2023 to 2025 data, after the way NAPLAN was measured changed in 2023, transformed NAPLAN scores into equivalent years of learning and compared it against parental occupation and education. It found an average student in year three who had one parent with a bachelor's degree or higher was 2 years and 3 months ahead of an average student whose parents had not completed school. By year nine, the gap had grown to 4 years and 3 months. The only exception was numeracy in year nine, where the gap shrunk by 3.2 months based on parental occupation and 2.3 months based on parental education. Mitchell Institute Senior Research Fellow Andres Molina said the issue was system-wide and structural. In a country that is progressive, that takes equity seriously, in every single state and territory, to see that has not materialised in closing the gap from students in different backgrounds, those gaps are widening, it's very problematic. He said increased competition between schools, a growing private school sector, inequitable funding and selective enrolment practices had contributed to a more segregated school system. Among 50 OECD member and partner countries, Molina said Australia had experienced the largest increase in school socioeconomic segregation over the past 20 years, according to unpublished research. The recent introduction of synthetic phonics in Victorian schools, explicit teaching, programs like free breakfast clubs, glasses, dental checks, affordable school uniforms, and group tutoring had helped reduce barriers for disadvantaged students, as well as school mental health menus. In Victoria, the gap in NAPLAN scores between advantaged and disadvantaged students for Year 3 reading closed between 2024 and 2025 from 90.5 to 88. But, Molina said, addressing the causes of concentrated disadvantage would have broader impacts. A spokesperson for the Victorian government said that the state's students were leading the nation in NAPLAN scores, with the lowest rates of additional support requirements. The spokesperson also called the rollout of the VCE vocational major in 2023 a game changer, saying it ensured more students than ever were completing senior secondary studies. But the report recommends a more explicit policy focus on funding schools operating in areas with concentrated disadvantage and targeted intervention at early learning services. It also says full-service schools or similar models can counter growing segregation where traditional schools aren't equipped to meet the challenge. Generally, full-service schools combine education, health, social and well-being supports for students and families in one place, allowing students to connect with services or resources needed to support better learning outcomes. In the United States, California invested roughly $5.75 billion to expand the full-service schools model in disadvantaged communities, alongside a community schools strategy. A review of 300 community schools in New York, similar to full-service schools, showed strong outcomes, including a drop in absenteeism, suspensions, and an increase in graduation. In Australia, a patchwork of schools across states and territories have implemented a range of initiatives, but Melina believes there needs to be a cohesive national approach. For 50-year-old Corio resident Kylie Thomas, who is a permanent carer for her three grandchildren, Isaiah 12, Ravi 11 and Ollie 10, the holistic place-based approach to education at her grandchildren's school has been life-changing. The children attend Northern Bay Peter 12 College in Corio, which is connected to one of nine Our Place sites that works with Victorian schools. Our Place acts as a glue between services, connecting students and families with community, council and state services. Of the 1,725 students at Northern Bay College, 76% are in the bottom quarter of socio-educational advantage. Thomas said having so many services in the one space meant families were more confident to ask for help if and when they needed it. No one's nervous or apprehensive to come and ask for the assistance because they know the people, Thomas said. If a child needs support, it's here. I think it makes a huge difference. If it wasn't like this, I don't think we'd have the community effect that we've got. Thomas said parents could also get English lessons and parenting support, while students can access psychology and health appointments and integrate early years with school. It's a wide, diverse and very inclusive. It's like a family. Our Place Chief Executive Sean Corey said the report confirmed what many Australians were experiencing. Educational inequality is not inevitable, he said. The Mitchell Institute report highlights the need to think differently about how schools and services work together if we want fairer outcomes for children. Corey said full-service schools helped with earlier identification of developmental concerns, built parent confidence to support learning at home, and improved access to services and family support. Too often families are left to navigate separate systems on their own while also dealing with challenges like insecure housing or putting food on the table. When services work together in a safe and welcoming environment instead of in silos, support becomes easier to access and more effective. Corey said that most Our Place sites, when compared to similar schools, there were early encouraging signs in NAPLAN results, as well as improved attendance and engagement. For Maryborough single mum Mary McManus, who is battling a terminal illness at 41, support from the Smith family, including a family coordinator, had made a remarkable difference to her three children's engagement in school. Maryborough mother Mary McManus, with her son Christopher, says the Smith family has supported them. Before, they were shy kids. They didn't shine like they do now and have the confidence they do now. It's given them confidence to be themselves. People don't realise how important that is. Doug Taylor, Chief Executive of the Smith family, said the number of schools with more than 50% of students in the lowest socioeconomic groups had increased over recent years from 17% in 2017 to 20% in 2023. We need a stronger coordinated system-level response that matches the scale of the challenge. That includes better targeting of resources to schools and communities with high levels of need. Federal Education Minister Jason Clare said the good news was that the average 8-year-old is now reading a year ahead of where they were 20 years ago. But the bad news is that the gap between the reading skills of 8-year-olds from wealthy families and those from poorer families had doubled. That's what we have got to fix. That's what the landmark agreement, Better Fairer Schools Agreement, we have struck with the states and territories is all about, he said. Clare said the agreement was tied to reforms to help kids catch up, keep up and finish school, including phonics checks, numeracy checks and small group tutoring. The Mitchell Institute's Melina acknowledged the agreement offered a good opportunity to make change. Everywhere, gaps are large. There's more inequality. If we continue doing the same thing that we're doing, we're not going to see this going the other way around, he said. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you, Andy. And of course, the only way forward in the whole question of equity is to pump the money back into the state schools, our public education system, and to get it out of the overfunded private schools. Let's have a break, shall we?
Become a subscriber and support Radical Radio. Call 03 9419 8377 or subscribe online at 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
3CR. Well, we hope you're still listening to the Dogs program, where we're on about public education. Of course, we all know that they have been underfunded and there are infrastructure problems. We need more high schools, and the schools that we've got need to be properly looked after. But the AEU have an infrastructure inquiry, and let's hear from Sorrel about this infrastructure inquiry, shall we?
Thanks, Jean. This article is by the New South Wales Teachers Federation Conference and is entitled Infrastructure Inquiry Reveals Must-Haves for Schools. You can be assured one of our priority recommendations will be the essential nature of co-design with teachers and community. Schools for Our Future Infrastructure Inquiry Chair Sharon Burrow told the annual conference. There is no doubt that where principals, teachers, specialist staff, Indigenous communities, parents and allied health professionals are involved, new builds and retrofits are much more suitable for maximising the benefits and the enjoyment of schooling. The Australian Education Union's inquiry is investigating the importance of infrastructure, the condition and safety of public school facilities, future needs, equity, inclusion, and funding. The panel will publish its report by October. The inquiry has consulted with public school teachers, principals, education support personnel and families, state and territory governments and key departments of education personnel, education stakeholders, including unions, community organisations, researchers and youth bodies, organisations representing Aboriginal peoples and Torres Strait Islander peoples, rural and remote Australians, young people experiencing disadvantage, and students with disability. Ms. Burrow said the complexities of teaching and learning, the scope of curriculum offering, student needs, health and wellbeing support, community building and community access, and support require fit-for-purpose infrastructure. She said the inquiry's nationwide consultations have revealed a broad set of must-have considerations. Space. Generous, flexible classrooms with the ability to accommodate all teaching and learning choices, including breakout rooms with a line of sight and dedicated spaces to enable the full scope of curriculum offerings. Light. Natural light and light and colour choices that support sensory well-being. Sound. Acoustics and soundproofing to maximise concentration and minimise disruptions. Full service. There is increasing support from teachers for well-being hubs with capacity for specialist services to provide student and community support. Early childhood. On-site provision is seen to support both student learning and parental choice. Before and after school care facilities. Support for parents and students that doesn't compromise learning spaces. School community meeting spaces. The need for halls and covered spaces that accommodate school students and the community to engage in and celebrate all school activities is vital. Pride of place, culture and community embedded in school art and design. Beyond indoor spaces, environment as a third teacher, trees, covered outdoor spaces and playgrounds. Sustainability, electrification with renewable energy, water tanks, insulation, double glazing and reliable heating and cooling. Toilets. Inquiry Deputy Chair Maury Mulheron encouraged members and schools to write a submission to the inquiry by the 31st of July, outlining how well current facilities are meeting the needs of students, teachers and staff, and what is required to ensure our schools are safe, modern, inclusive and fit for purpose in the future. We're not looking for essays, just half a page and some photos, Mr. Mulheron said. The stories will help build an evidence base for future campaigning for recurrent federal capital works funding. At present, there is no ongoing federal infrastructure funding for public schools, while private schools receive extensive federal funding. Back over to you, Jean.
Yes, well, thank you very much. And of course, The reason why so many of the private schools are overfunded with their infrastructure is because they don't have to pay any taxes. And particularly with the wealthy ones, they don't pay any rates either. So the people over there have to pay more rates. And there's a councillor who's had something to say about this, and we're grateful to the rationalists who have been promoting this idea. So over to Councillor and Dale.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article from the Rationalist Society. Cy Gladman writes, subsidisation of religious sites and private schools, an unjust burden for ratepayers, says Victorian councillor. Almost 2% of rates collected at an inner city Melbourne council is subsidising religion and private schools in what one councillor has described as an unjust burden on ratepayers. At a meeting of the Burundura Council late last month, Councillor Rob Bailiu sought to table a confidential council report that detailed the cost of rates exemptions. Although the report was not made public following the meeting, Councillor Bailiu had, in a speech broadcast as part of the council meeting, detailed many of the key findings in the report. He said that 279 of 801 properties exempted from rates were religious sites, while another 76 sites were for private education. Taken together, he said, these sites represented $2.7 billion of the total $5.44 billion of exempted property in the council area, and about 1.8% of the total property that could be rated. That functionally means that in Burundura, 1.8% of all rates go to subsidising religion and private education, he said. This is both inconsistent with the separation of church and state and an unjust burden on ratepayers. Because of these exemptions, the burden is spread onto all other ratepayers. In his speech to the meeting, Councillor Bailiu said that removal of all rates exemptions, applying also to public education sites and, for example, the land used by health services and charities, would deliver an annual $75 reduction in rates for median residential ratepayers and save them about $865 over 10 years. The Burundura City Council, located in Melbourne's inner eastern suburbs, has an existing policy opposing rates exemptions and has previously called on the Victorian government to remove these exemptions. Under the state's Local Government Act 1989, exemptions to rates apply to land used exclusively for charitable purposes, religious worship, or purposes directly connected with religious activities, and education. As these are state laws, councils have no power to rate such properties. The council's revenue and rating plan 2025-29 said the foregone revenue represents a significant portion of the potential rating base and highlights the importance of ensuring equity among remaining ratepayers. A 2019-20 Victorian review of statutory rate exemptions by an independent panel recommended, among other things, repealing exemptions for land used exclusively for charity purposes and for a public benefit test to be applied, while noting that religious schools would likely become rateable under such a test. However, the state Labor government rejected recommendations calling for changes to the current exemption arrangements. In a submission to the 2019-20 review, the Municipal Association of Victoria, MAV, highlighted Burundura as an example of how private schools in the council area were exempted to the tune of more than $1.3 million annually in rates. That MAV submission argued that private schools placed a burden on councils due to the traffic generated, plus the costs of road and other infrastructure. The submission also noted that some private schools lease out their facilities to commercial activities, such as swim schools. There is no broad-based community justification for these commercial entities being subsidised by the housing LGA ratepayers when other alternate commercial providers are not subsidised, the submission said. And now we're going to play an excerpt of what Councillor Bailiu said at the meeting.
As we adopt our budget and move to issue rate notices, I felt it timely to note that it is the adopted position of Council to oppose rate exemptions and call on the state government to end unjust rate exemptions. $5.44 billion worth of properties in Birrindara are currently exempt from paying rates. If rates were charged on this land, it would contribute more than $7 million to Council's rating base in 25-26. The median rate in Birrindara is around $2,100. If exemptions were removed, it would afford the median ratepayer a $75 reduction in their rates. Over a 10-year period, this would deliver approximately $865 in cumulative savings per median value residential ratepayer. 279 of the 801 properties exempt from rates in Birrindara are religious sites and 76 are private education sites. Collectively, they represent $2.7 billion worth of property, or approximately 1.8% of the property that could be rated. That functionally means that in Birrindara, 1.8% of all rates go to subsidising religion and private education. This is both inconsistent with the separation of church and state and an unjust burden on ratepayers. In support of this, I would like to formally table a report from Birrindara Council on rate exemptions and once again reiterate the opposition of this council to rate exemptions and their unjust burden on ratepayers.
Back to you, Jean.
Well, in recent weeks, we've been telling you about the New South Wales, Mr. McInerney in the Catholic Education Office, who's been in a spot of trouble because money has been going from the Catholic Education Office to the Liberal Party coffers up there. The question is it taxpayers' money? Let's hear from Dale again.
Thanks, Jean. This is an article from The Guardian by Penry Buckley and Krishani Danji. Alleged illegal donations by Catholic Schools New South Wales to Liberals raise questions over use of taxpayer funds. Catholic Schools New South Wales' alleged donations to the Liberal Party show the need to ensure public money is spent for approved purposes, expert says. An education funding expert says alleged illegal donations by Catholic Schools New South Wales to Liberal Party operatives under investigation by the State Corruption Watchdog show government's need to check taxpayer funding was being spent according to its purposes and not funneled into political donations. The Independent Commission Against Corruption, ICAC, is investigating allegations that political donations were made by Catholic Schools New South Wales in amounts that were not declared and exceeded applicable donation caps. It is alleged the donations were arranged and approved by the Catholic Schools New South Wales Chief Executive, Dallas McInerney, to recruit or renew members to the party, a practice known as branch stacking. Catholic Schools New South Wales is the governing body for nearly 600 schools. Trevor Cobold, the convener of the advocacy group Save Our Schools, and a former Productivity Commission economist, said the Commonwealth and state governments should act alongside the ICAC investigation in the face of very serious allegations to jointly audit Catholic Schools New South Wales. Cobold said nearly 80% of funding for Catholic schools comes from federal and state funding, or around $3.8 billion in 2024. As a registered charity with the Australian Charities and Not-for-Profits Commission, ACNC, it would be at risk of losing its charitable status and tax exemptions if it is found to have a disqualifying political purpose. The Commonwealth Department of Education, the Federal Minister for Education, and the New South Wales Minister for Education can't stand aside as if they are uninterested observers, Cobold said. They have specific responsibilities that are not those of ICAC to ensure public money is being spent according to its purposes, and in order to do that, they need to have a joint audit of the books of Catholic Schools New South Wales. It does raise broader issues about how school organisations account for taxpayer funding. Chris Bonner, a former president of the New South Wales Secondary Principals Council and author of Waiting for Gonski, How Australia Failed Its Schools, said the allegations call for much more stringent monitoring of compliance by private schools with regulations. Along with unequal obligations on the public and private sector, there's been unequal regulations and unequal accountabilities. On Tuesday, Chris Minns said his government would wait for the ICAC investigation to begin, but ruled out an immediate audit of Catholic Schools New South Wales. "We don't have any plans to do it. I think we should wait for that to at least begin," the New South Wales Premier said in Sydney. "I think we should wait for it to report both to Parliament and other independent bodies." A spokesperson for the New South Wales Liberal leader, Kelly Sloan, declined to comment on Tuesday. Sloan, when previously asked about the possibility of public funds being used in alleged donations, said no stone should be left unturned. "But these are very serious allegations, and I trust the ICAC to do its work," she told reporters earlier this month. The New South Wales Greens have called for a separate audit of Catholic Schools New South Wales and renewed their push to stop the public funding of private schools. The idea that public funds going to Catholic schools and being misused and misappropriated is outrageous. Any school that is alleged to have engaged in corrupt conduct should have all public funds denied until the investigation is conducted, said Tamara Smith, the New South Wales Greens education spokesperson. In separate statements to Guardian Australia, the Federal Education Department and New South Wales Education Standards Authority, NESA, refused to comment on the allegations. A spokesperson for NESA said, "As these matters are the subject of an active ICAC investigation, we are unable to comment." In a statement, the ACNC said it was aware of ICAC's investigation of claims in relation to Catholic Schools New South Wales Limited. The ACNC will monitor the ongoing ICAC investigation, it said. Cobold argued two inquiries into the allegations could run concurrently and pointed to the Royal Commission into Anti-Semitism and Social Cohesion taking place at the same time as the criminal investigation of the Bondi terror attack. Inquiries in the past, take the Royal Commission, they can overlap. One organisation is meeting its legal responsibilities and the other organisation should be meeting theirs. And by that, I mean the New South Wales and Commonwealth governments and the Charities Commission, he said. The ICAC probe is part of a wider investigation of allegations against individuals connected to the Liberal Party, including McInerney, property developer Jean Nassif, and two brothers of the former Liberal Premier Dominic Perrottet, Jean-Claude and Charles, who have all previously denied wrongdoing. Perrottet is not accused of any wrongdoing. McInerney was appointed as the inaugural chief executive of Catholic Schools New South Wales in 2017. The former member of the Liberal state executive is a factional ally of the federal Liberal leader, Angus Taylor, who is not accused of any wrongdoing. In a statement reported by the Sydney Morning Herald, McInerney said he had offered to stand aside to allow the work of Catholic Schools New South Wales to continue its important mission. Catholic Schools New South Wales has been contacted for comment. Back to you, Jean.
Well, thank you very much, Dale. Now we're off overseas with Jeff. Over to you, Jeff.
Good afternoon, listeners. Today we're going to do an article from the Progressive magazine by Jonathan Sawyer. It begins, "The US Supreme Court may continue the culture war around religion and LGBTQ plus personhood. In my personal experiences with conversion therapy as a late adolescent, one of the fundamental harms that I encountered was the demand that I must either choose religious identity or an LGBTQIA plus identity, a framing that prevented a healthy integration of my faith and personhood for many years. A case that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear will likely deepen a troubling precedent that establishes religious identity and LGBTQ plus identity as oppositional and perhaps even irreconcilable, a profoundly misguided approach that can lead to LGBTQIA plus students being discriminated against and disproportionately harmed in publicly funded school systems. since at least the 2018 decision in Masterpiece Cake Shop Limited versus Colorado Civil Rights Commission. Involving a Christian baker who refused to bake a wedding cake for a gay couple, the US Supreme Court has implicitly embraced the view that religious identity and LGBTQ plus identity are incompatible. When religious groups claim that LGBTQ plus inclusion is anathema to their values, the rights of the religious group must prevail over those of the LGBTQI plus people. I'll just point out that this is an aside. We say LGBTQIA plus here on 3CR, but I'm just reading an article from the States where they have LGBTQ, just excuse that. Next year in St. Mary Catholic Parish versus Roy, the court may more explicitly give constitutional protection to faith-based discrimination against LGBTQ plus students in religious schools. The St. Mary case concerns Colorado's Universal Preschool Program, UPK, enacted in 2022, which provides every child in the state with up to 15 hours of tuition-free preschool per week during their year before kindergarten through state funding grants to schools. Though these funds can be used for private religious education, the program prohibits eligible schools from excluding students and families based on sexual orientation and gender identity. In 2023, St. Mary's Catholic Parish in Littleton, Colorado, sought and was denied a religious exception to this requirement for its preschool. St. Mary's appealed to the US Supreme Court, arguing that the non-discrimination requirements of Colorado's UPK forced the school to abandon its religious beliefs regarding sexuality and therefore violated their First Amendment rights to religious freedom. The court agreed to hear the case in keeping with their eagerness to weigh religious freedom arguments in recent years. The Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, Council for St. Mary, argues on its website that the school's First Amendment religious freedom protections have been violated. Moreover, the firm argues that Colorado's LGBTQIA plus inclusive non-discrimination rules threaten the ability for religious schools to maintain their religious identity. But St. Mary is just one installment in a series of recent legal efforts designed to retrench conservative norms on gender and sexual identity in the law. In the 2025 case Mahmoud versus Taylor, religious parents gained the right to receive notice and then opt their children out of LGBTQ plus inclusive lessons in public schools across the country. Also in 2025, the United States versus Schermetti, the Supreme Court upheld a Tennessee law restricting medical treatment for transgender minors. Undergirding St. Mary's is a polarising viewpoint that frames religious identity and LGBTQI plus identity as at odds with one another. In some parts of the world, such views have led to the stark criminalisation of homosexuality with the death penalty sometimes imposed. Certainly, religious and LGBTQ plus identities can be viewed as incompatible, especially when those religious views are upheld by the law. Such views include the idea that homosexuality is a sin and the notion that transgender identities are a perversion of the natural order. St. Mary's is fundamentally about a clash of worldviews, one that seeks to protect LGBTQ plus students and families against faith-based discrimination, and one that relies upon religion to justify root discrimination. St. Mary makes the very meaning of the term discrimination central to the case. One person's experience of discrimination based on LGBTQ plus identity is pitted against another's defence of their religious identity, according to the Beckett Fund, which argues that if Colorado's UPK program violates religious conscience, it's a form of discrimination against religious families. But education law expert Kevin Wellner has drawn attention to how taxpayer-funded public schools must comply with anti-discrimination laws, whereas taxpayer-funded private religious schools are largely exempt from complying with those laws. To get around anti-discrimination regulations, Wellner shows how lawmakers are essentially outsourcing discrimination against LGBTQ plus students to private educational contractors. If St. Mary's Catholic Parish prevails, such outsourcing of discrimination will become more accessible nationwide. The St. Mary litigation advances some troublesome blurring of public and private, as well as the larger religious and political vision of privatising education on the public's dime. And a Supreme Court victory for the parish, which is the anticipated outcome, will usher in an era of religiously motivated, taxpayer-funded and constitutionally protected discrimination against students. St. Mary's and recent cases connecting religious identity, LGBTQ plus identity and schools are about the norms that the majority of justices on the court view as under threat by LGBTQ plus visibility. If, as some claim, marriage equality cannot realistically be rolled back, today's court seems to be doing everything in its power to cement discriminatory norms in other spheres, especially in education.
In Mahmood v. Taylor, Justice Samuel Alito directly expressed his concern with the upending of traditional norms regarding sexuality and gender. His majority opinion referred to the LGBTQ plus inclusive curriculum as a threat to these norms, those that maintain LGBTQ plus invisibility. Justice Alito wrote, "The LGBTQ plus inclusive books are unmistakably normative. They are designed to present certain values and beliefs as things to be celebrated and certainly contrary values and beliefs as things to be rejected." The plaintiffs in Mahmood were religious, and the subtext of Justice Alito's concern is undeniably religious in nature. Yet even as the court's conservative justices are pushing as diligently as possible to roll back gains made for LGBTQ plus visibility in schools and to frame LGBTQ plus identity and religious identity as oppositional, we should also remember that this is not a new strategy. In her book, White Evangelical Racism, religion and politics expert Anthea Butler describes how religious freedom arguments also undergirded racist resistance to school integration. Butler notes that in the decades following the 1954 case Brown versus Board of Education, some evangelical Christians began to use the language of religious freedom to exclude LGBTQ persons from civil rights. The conservative majority on today's Supreme Court wields religious freedom to explicitly discriminate against LGBTQ plus students and families, rather than a shield to protect the religious liberties of all people, including LGBTQ plus folks. Let's not forget that LGBTQ plus students of faith and their families do exist, if only their religious freedoms were fought for as fiercely. But the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty and the Aligned Justices have brought into the anti-democratic notion that religious identity and LGBTQ plus identity are incompatible. Alarmingly, as constitutional law expert Andrew Koppelman has warned, our nation's cherished right of religious freedom has increasingly turned towards religious privilege, as the Supreme Court has in recent years placed religion in such a privileged position that any exemption for religious people or institutions at all can be justified. Today's so-called religious freedom movement often positions LGBTQ plus identity as a threat to religious identity. These contemporary activists for religious privilege amplify a public rhetoric that pits religion against LGBTQ plus people and vice versa. This nation's founders were explicitly wary of faith-based harm. They tried to craft a constitution that would help us avoid the mistakes of centuries of religious warfare, and their handiwork is being destroyed by the current court. And that's the end of the article. But I just want to just mention the way that the Supreme Court is being used as a weapon in the culture wars by the evangelical right. They're using it to divide people, to pass the public purse and steal public education dollars and point them into religious and private charter schools. This is a deliberate strategy by the far right. They're backed by billionaires. So the religious right is in the process of trying to dismantle public education altogether. They would like to abolish it. They tried to abolish the education department entirely. And, of course, they want to destroy it because they can't make money out of public purse unless they do. And with that, I'm going to pass you back to the headquarters and wish you a very nice weekend. Cheerio.
Now let's have a break, shall we?
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM. Visit the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/podcast to hear the most recent recording from each show, or 3cr.org.au/streaming to listen live.
Well, we hope you're still with us because this is the best part of the program. Out there in Hoppers Crossing, there's great things being done with, again, too little funds, but the public system is still far and away the best system because it's there for all of the children and the children come first. Let's hear about our great state school from the week from Andy.
Thanks, Jean. And this week's great state school of the week is Grange Peter 12 College in Hoppers Crossing. Now, The Age reported on July 19 that this school has turned the page on its poor reading results. Going back to the book to treat reading as a standalone subject has helped one school turn around desperate literacy levels over the past 2 years and may offer evidence for others to follow. Almost a quarter of students at the Grange Peter 12 College started Year 7 reading at a prep to grade 2 level in 2024, providing educators with evidence that a complete overhaul of its literacy program was required. In response, the Hoppers Crossing School expanded a trial to treat reading as a standalone subject and saw an immediate boost in NAPLAN literacy results across year levels in 2026. The Grange's Core Literacy Coordinator, Clara Tran, said secondary schools typically treat reading as something that happens within wider English classes. We made reading its own subject with its own teachers and its own curriculum, and that's why the reading data moved significantly, Tran said. 1 in 3 Australian students failed to meet NAPLAN benchmarks last year, with the gap widening between advantaged and disadvantaged students. But students at the Grange, about 40% of whom receive adjustments in 2025 due to disability, defied the national trend by demonstrating sustained improvement. More than 30% of Year 7 to 9 students recorded high relative growth in NAPLAN reading scores from 2024 to 2026, compared to 24% of students at similar schools. Tran said the core literacy model works because it has its own dedicated time and teachers from all subject areas are trained to deliver it. The evidence doesn't support that reading fixes itself through exposure to texts in English class, she said. It has to be taught directly, systematically, on its own. Literacy academic Carol Christensen developed the whole school approach to reading, which sees students split into small groups based on 4 levels of reading ability. The core literacy model has also shown promising results at Braybrook College and Sunshine College, which the Grattan Institute has highlighted as a benchmark for school transformation. This year, all Year 7 and 8 students attended 3 weekly lessons at the Grange and were encouraged to undertake 20 minutes of reading at home after school. Library data shows an almost 70% increase in book borrowing since the program began. Principal David Smilly said that although kids' interest in reading had declined in the 50 years he'd been teaching, the Grange had pushed a strong academic agenda in the last 3 to 4 years. Kids are really engaged in reading, and certainly the core lit has helped promote that, he said. Smilly said parents faced a battle at home getting children to pick up books instead of mobile phones. All aspects of learning need to be habit. If we can build reading into their daily routine, that's where we'll really generate the skills, he said. While the Grange won't know what impact core literacy has on VCE until the first cohort of students trained in it do exams, Smilly said the school already had one of its best VCE results last year. Interestingly, the ducks at the school was also the ducks of reading. She read a record 600 books in her time at the school. And now the principal's message. At the Grange Peter 12 College, our school community aims to provide all students with an educational setting that is engaging, challenging and caters for individual needs, is safe and promotes positive well-being, meets individual academic and pastoral needs and prepares students for higher education and or employment, promotes participation and empowerment of children, develops effective communication skills, promotes a sense of belonging to our community, and is underpinned by our college values of respect, learning and working together. The following initiatives support our aims. A strong focus on building high skill levels in literacy and numeracy, and specialised classes to cater for individual learning needs. A new innovative STEM program that encompasses students solving complex problems by working collaboratively on projects that utilise leading-edge technologies such as coding, robotics and 3D printing. A specialised program focusing on sports and science. Students will experience highly individualised programs around soccer, volleyball and rugby. These specialised programs will be supported via relationships with sports clubs and Deakin and Victoria Universities. Students will also be offered specialised electives tailored around exercise science, health and wellbeing, human movement and Sports Science Academy subschool. All of these programs will be designed to lead into VET, VCAL and VCE study. We have also established partnerships with National Rugby League and Rugby Victoria to develop an elite coaching program for students from grades 5 to 12. Students also engage in our athletics development program 2 mornings per week in our specialised training gymnasium. A highly effective school-wide positive behaviour program across preps to year 12. School counsellors are embedded in each of the sub-schools. A comprehensive information technology program that has created a more dynamic learning environment. A High Achievers program is part of our Year 7 program and is designed to enrich and extend students' learning. A language program encompassing the Hindi culture at years prep to 6 and expanding to secondary year levels. I am very confident that the Grange P-12 College will provide an excellent education for your child across all stages of learning from prep to year 12. Our structure provides a great opportunity for continual, highly monitored and supportive learning, as well as to really know and build excellent relationships with families. And now some facts and figures from the My School website. The enrolment, 1,919. The ICSEA value, below average at 973, representative of a diverse outer urban community. The upper quartile of socio-educational advantage only accounts for 7% of students at this school. The second quartile, 18%. The third quartile of socio-educational advantage, i.e. below average, is 29%, and the lowest quartile of socio-educational advantage accounts for 47% of the students at this school, with 62% having a language background other than English and 3% Indigenous students. The finances, recurrent grants from the Australian Government of $7.347 million and the Victorian Government, $27.537 million. Private fees add $583,884,000 and other private contributions, another $302,000. And that works out as $18,601 per student, which is approximately the current SRS amount under the Gonski funding model, which sounds good, except we would expect this school to attract a significant funding loading due to socioeconomic disadvantage and potentially other loadings as well, for example, a disability loading. Once again, a state school producing amazing results despite inappropriate funding levels. The capital, $3.28 million over 3 years. Back to you, Jean.
Well, congratulations to the Grange P-12 College out there in Hoppers Crossing. And our time is gone. So if you want to find out more about the dogs, you can go to our website at www.adogs.info. And it's now time for me to thank our wonderful producer, Dale, and her offsider, Andy, and, of course, Sol and Jeff. But from all of us here at 3CR and the dogs, it's bye for now.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he. In Salt Lake City, Joe says I, him standing by my bed. They framed you on a murder charge, says Joe, but I'm dead. Says Joe, but I'm dead. The copper bosses killed you, Joe. They shot you, Joe, says I. Takes more than guns to kill a man, says Joe, I didn't die. Says Joe, I didn't die. And standing there as big as life and smiling with his eyes, says Joe, what they can never kill, went on to organize. Went on to organize. From San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where workers strike and organize, it's there you'll find your hill. It's there you'll find. I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
Become a 3CR subscriber today. Go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe or call the station on 03 9419 8377. Be a part of your community radio station.
3CR.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We rely on the financial support of listeners like yourself to keep going. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au and thanks for your support.